This is Native America Calling. I'm Mandy Murphy. From traditional Anishinaabe songs and the natural world to the daughter of Satan, there's no subject out of bounds for Native American poets to explore. We'll hear from Tiffany Midge, Kinsel Drake, Marcy Rendon, and Kim Blazer, who will give us samples of new poems that pry open our understanding of the forces they encounter every day. We are celebrating women poets coming up right after the news.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The former chairman of the Eastern Shoshone Tribe has announced a bid for the Wyoming House. Wyoming Public Radio's Chris Clements reports that if he wins in November, he'll be the only Native American representative in the state legislature.
Ivan Posey is running as a conservative Democrat against Lander Representative Sarah Penn for House District 33, which encompasses part of the Wind River Reservation. Posey says if elected, his priorities include allowing traditional Eastern Shoshone and Northern Arapaho beliefs and teaching methods to be a bigger part of school curricula on Wind River.
Whether that's through beadwork or setting up a teepee or, you know, just our hand games, some of our cultural things that help students succeed in those areas.
Posey added that he'd also like to secure more health care funding for tribal members on the reservation. Cheyenne Senator Afi Ellis, who is Navajo, is currently the only Native politician in Cheyenne. She recently announced that she'll retire from the legislature in 2025. Currently, the Wyoming legislature is overwhelmingly white, male, and Republican, with only a handful of Native American officials elected since 1980. I'm Chris Clements.
The Burt Lake Band of Ottawa and Chippewa Indians have preserved the tribe's history in northern Michigan with a new book. The history includes the violent colonization of the band's village in the year 1900 and the legal battles that persist to this day. Interlochen Public Radio's Michael Livingston was shown around what used to be Indian Village and spoke with the tribe's historian who helped compile the book, A Cloud Over the Land.
On the top of a hill overlooking an icy Burt Lake, Ken Parkey walks through a small cemetery filled with a few dozen white crosses. He scans the land, looking for signs of an old settlement.
I was always told it was down in that area, right down in there? Yeah, about where that little valley is there, back, kind of back over that way. That's where I was told where it was at.
Several of Parkey's ancestors are buried here. Some lived in the original settlement that stood here more than a century ago. Back then, the village had log cabins made with lumber from a nearby sawmill and was a thriving community. Then came October 15th, 1900, when a group of men, including a sheriff and a land speculator, burned the village down with kerosene. The book, A Cloud Over the Land, tells the story about how the Burt Lake Band lost that land, but also about the fight to get it back. Even now, the band is trying to obtain federal reaffirmation, which would return the label of sovereign nation to the Northwest Peninsula on Burt Lake. Tribal historian Deborah Richmond says she hopes the book will remind the region and the country that the band still remains.
Only now when we can tell our story and when people can hear our story are we allowed to start healing. We would like to focus on the good parts of our culture, but there's this just big piece. It very much is a cloud over our families and over our history because we want to right the wrongs that happened to our ancestors.
A Cloud Over the Land is available to purchase on the Burt Lake Band website. Richmond says the book has already sold over 500 copies. For National Native News, I'm Michael Livingston.
On Wednesday, the Johnson County Sheriff's Office in Kansas released a statement saying they do not suspect foul play in the death of Cole Bringsplenty. The Haskell Indian Nations University student and actor went missing from Lawrence on March 31st. He was found deceased on April 5th in Johnson County. His disappearance and death hit the Haskell community and the greater Kansas City Native community hard. People across Indian country also showed support to his family and friends. Funeral services are being held this weekend on the Cheyenne River Sioux Reservation in South Dakota, where Bringsplenty is from. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
We'll be right back. National Native News is produced by Kawanak Broadcast Corporation with funding by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Support by Sanofsky Chambers Law, championing tribal sovereignty and Native American rights since 1976, from opioids litigation to treaty rights to tribal self-governance, with offices in Washington, D.C., New Mexico, California, and Alaska. Sanofsky Chambers Law.
Support by the Gathering of Nations Powwow, a live event taking place April 25th, 26th, and 27th on the powwow grounds of Expo New Mexico, featuring song, dance, traders market, horse parade, and more. Tickets available at gatheringofnations.com and at the gates.
Native Voice 1, the Native American Radio Network.
This is Native America Calling. I'm Andy Murphy, sitting in for Sean Spruce. Native women have a powerful story to tell, and the four poets we have on today exemplify the creativity and vibrance of their cultures with their art form. April is National Poetry Month, and they will help us celebrate it. Anishinaabe poet Marcy Rendon's new book of poetry is inspired by translations of short verse traditional songs. Tiffany Midge, Lakota poet and author, always serves up off-kilter stories with a healthy side of humor. Dine poet and founder of the Indian Girls Book Club, Kinsel Drake, tacked on the task of delivering thousands of books to rural Native communities to her work as a literature influencer. And White Earth poet Kimberly Blazer is touring the country to promote her new book of poetry, Ancient Light. We'll hear from these poets this hour, and you can join us too. Which Native poets are you enjoy reading right now? We're at 1-800-996-2848. That's also 1-800-99-NATIVE. Joining us now from Beloit, Wisconsin, is Kimberly Blazer. She's a poet, author of Ancient Light, founding director of Indigenous Nations Poets, an MFA member, a faculty member at the IAIA. She's also the Mackey Chair in Creative Writing at Beloit College. She's Anishinaabe from the White Earth Reservation. Welcome to Native America Calling, Kim.
Who's you, Andy? It's great to be here.
Thank you so much for joining us, too. So, like I mentioned, you've been touring to promote Ancient Light since it came out in January. Is there a central theme or story or inspiration behind this latest book of yours?
There's a trajectory. It begins looking at colonization and all of the impacts of colonization, and then looks at what are the pathways of resilience and healing and flourishing for Indigenous peoples. And I call those sometimes ancient light. And so it looks at that, as well as the ways that racism was manifested in the pandemic, and how all of us had to confront it in new ways. And again, how do we heal from that?
Okay. And how much different is it from some of your other writing?
It is different in the sense that I've been doing this project, which I call Pictopoems. So there's layers of text and image, or there's ekphrastic poetry, which is image and poem together. And this is the first time that they've been included in one of my poetry books. I also give a little more attention to the architecture of the page, so the way the poem appears on the page, space as well as language and visual becomes one of the elements that you read, as well as the words themselves.
Okay. Yeah, I had a question about that. What is the significance of space on a page? And we're talking about like actual space. Sometimes there's, a whole 10 or so spaces between words, and, you have these different stanzas that are different sizes, and they, it appears on a page very, in a very specific way. I mean, what's the significance of that as a poet?
Well, there are several. One of them is a lot of times space will just represent like breath, like how do we read it, right? Or also pause. But also I use it to engage the reader in the act of making meaning with the poem. So it's a space where the reader can enter and engage with what's on the page and try to figure out the meaning with the poem. So I feel like if you put things against one another, if you juxtapose things and don't necessarily explain them, but the reader is required to rub them together and create a spark or a light, that is another way of engaging the reader.
Okay. And do you expect the readers to be to reach like an answer or one specific thing to fill that space?
I am a great believer in ambiguity. I feel like we're always on the way to tracing, searching for, meaning. And if we get to what we think is the meaning, we're probably wrong. And that we're, it's a process. And so I'd love to pull people into the process of discovery and, into the thinking so that I'm not necessarily delivering a product, but I'm asking them to help me in thinking through these topics or issues that I am presenting through the poems.
Okay. All right. Well, let's hear one of your poems from Ancient Light.
All right. This is an early poem, and so it's coming out of that project of colonization and what it has wrought and the sort of possession, even possession of women's bodies. Poem on disappearance. Beginning with our continent, draw 1491. Each mountain, compass point, indigenous. Trace trade routes, languages, seasonal migrations. Don't become attached. Yes, reshape by discovery, displacement. Move your pencil point quickly now, as if pursued. A cavalry of possession that erases homelands. We shrink in time lapse of colonial barter, disappear. Now draw a brown face painted for ceremony, half a face, nothing. Draw nothing around a crumpled bird body, no wings. Draw emptiness inside desecrated burial mounds, a stretch of absence where fallopian tubes once curved in hope. Sketch void across buffalo prairie. Draw the empty of elk, of passenger pigeons, of silver trout. Conjure with your hand the shape of girl blooming, curves of face, her laughing eyes, you've seen them, postered and amber alerted, missing, evening news, and gone. Draw a woman wrapped in a blanket, a child's body weighted, draw stones sinking into every river on the map. Draw carrion, blackening skies, carrion, plucking vision from round, brown faces. Draw missing, draw murdered. Work carefully now. Turn your hand to the new continent. Again, picture it. Nothing.
Thank you for that, Kim. So tell us a little bit more about that poem. It says a lot about, like you said, colonization, but tell us a little bit more about it.
Sure. I wanted to actively get people to think about all of the ways that colonization has manifested and all of the disappearances, all of the theft, all of the possessions. And so I instruct them to do something. So I'm trying to pull them into the so that they become closer to understanding what has happened. If they're asked to draw, to, you know, trace, to, you know, to do these things. But also I want to, I think, startle a little, because sometimes we become complacent, right? Mm-hmm. Yes, I've heard that story before. But we see all the milk cartons. We see all, so yeah, these are real people that are disappearing. So the Amber Alerts and the news reports and all of that, those are not just like, you know, surface things. We have to realize what are the stories behind them. And I'm trying to gesture. I would think of poetry as an act of attention or an act of gesture. And I'm trying to gesture towards those stories. So when I talk about, for example, Tayo's body weighted, you know, wrapped in blankets, that's actually an incident that happened in North Dakota, fairly close to my home reservation. Mm-hmm. So again, I'm trying to make these things real to people.
Yeah, I think I know the incident you're talking about. Well, yeah, thank you. Thank you for expanding on that. I want to ask a question about Indigenous Nations poets. Tell us a little bit more about that and who is all involved there.
So we're fairly new. We were founded in 2020. I founded this organization, and we have this beautiful group of incredibly talented Indigenous writers on our board of directors. And we are committed to mentoring emerging writers, because I know that Marcy and I, and you know, and probably Tiffany, we didn't have people really to help us find our way in the writing world. And so this, we're trying to celebrate also the all Native poetics, because I think Indigenous poetry has not gotten as much attention as it should. And part of what we do in that is we want to look at the way that poetry helps to sustain our nations, because art has always been a part of Indigenous reality. And our latest initiative is Language Back. So we're trying to use poetry to support language revitalization.
Okay.
But the organization has held several mentoring retreats.
Hey, Kim, we'll talk about those retreats right after this break. You're listening to Native America Calling. Two tribes are among the growing list of institutions taking on big social media companies for what they say is a growing youth mental health crisis. Are social media platforms harming young people's view of themselves and the world? And if so, what can be done about it? We'll explore those questions on the next Native America Calling.
Support provided by Amerind. Amerind is 100% tribally owned and partners with tribes and their businesses to provide affordable commercial insurance coverage, protect tribal sovereignty, and strengthen Native American communities by helping to keep dollars in Indian country. Information about property, liability, commercial auto, and workers' comp available at Amerind.com. That's Amerind.com.
This is Native America Calling. I'm Andy Murphy, and we're talking with Native poets today about their work as we observe National Poetry Month. You can join us too. How has poetry helped you see things in a different way or better understand Native life? We're at 1-800-996-2848. That's also 1-800-99-NATIVE. I'm going to go back to Kimberly Blazer here. Kim, you were talking about Indigenous Nations poets, and tell me a little bit about that retreat you mentioned, and then how have you seen the Native poetry scene change over the years you've been a writer?
Sure. The first retreat we had was in Washington, D.C., when Joy Harjo was closing out her term as U.S. Poet Laureate, and she was with us, and we had 16 emerging writers for a week to work with established writers. We have, you know, professionalization panels, helping them think ahead to to publishing. We have crafts, workshops. It's a really immersion for these young writers. And so we've done that twice now, and our next one will be in the Twin Cities this summer. And Marcy's actually going to be there one day and talk to the fellows. And Kinsale was one of our very first inaugural fellows for that DC retreat. So we've seen a lot of really wonderful things happen. And just to say, Indigenous Nations Poets is open to any Indigenous poet. We're trying to do programming online. Slated a submission, a training and submissions coming up. So just connect with us and you can sit in on any of these workshops except for that retreat that's, you know, for which we select people. But as far as the way that Indigenous poetry has changed, I think it's become a larger, more expansive universe of poetry for Indigenous writers. I think that what we're doing in our work has begun to break out of the boundaries of what, you know, Western literary people have expected of us, and we've been more free to do that. So I think a lot of new writers are especially making use of elements that are not only print. And so I think that's really exciting. And there's just, I feel like the present right now is a really important moment for Indigenous writers in general. I think it's just one of those really bursting with incredible work out there. And I love to see us maintain that.
All right. Nice. Well, let's actually go to Marcy Rendon from Minneapolis, Minnesota. She's a writer and author. She's White Earth Ojibwe as well. Welcome to Native America Calling, Marcy.
Hi. Thank you for having me.
Right. What did you learn about traditional ways of telling stories and songs through Gerald Visner's interpretation? That's what you have in one of the first pages of your books, of your new book, Anishinaabe Songs for a New Millennium, which comes out in a couple months from now. But I have it in my hands and I was just looking at the page there and I wanted to ask that question. What did you learn about traditional ways of telling stories or songs from Gerald Visner? And tell us who Gerald Visner is.
Gerald Visner is an author also from White Earth. And I believe it was in 1963, he had published Summer in the Spring, Anishinaabe Lyric Poems and Stories, which were old songs, but they were interpreted into English. And I somehow read that book, and it was similar enough to the kinds of things that I was writing, but without the Ojibwe language, that it just kind of motivated me to keep doing what I was doing.
Okay. And here you say, you know, it encouraged you to write in short verse. Tell me about that and what you noticed about the way your ancestors had this style of singing and telling stories.
So many of the songs are, you know, like short phrases. They're almost like haiku, but they're not measured in the same way, but they're that short. And then when they're sung on the hand drum or the drum, there are those words that are sung in Ojibwe, but then there's lots of vocables, which are sounds that carry through the song. And then each song is sung like four times. So it's that short, and these short gathering of words creates a whole image for the listener or for whoever's singing it. And that, you know, like we were always taught that if you get quiet enough, you can hear the spirits giving you your song, that each person has a song. But in today's world, things get so noisy and we're so hooked into machines that oftentimes people forget to really listen for the song that is like being sent to them. But traditionally, everyone had their own song.
Okay. And you mentioned dream songs, and those are part of the book as well. What are dream songs?
They're songs. They tend to be very short, but they're the kinds of writing where I would be sound asleep. I would wake up at 2 o'clock in the morning with that phrase just boom right there. And they're about really paying attention to the spirit world, not just this world.
All right. Well, let's hear a poem from Anishinaabe Songs for a New Millennium.
Okay. And they're really not titled, so I don't know in the table of contents if they've been titled, but this one is from page 5, and it's in 4, like, segments. 1, grandmother walks moonlit trails, sucking maple syrup cubes. Birch bark wraps itself around her while black bear guards her path. At the water's edge, in a rock upon the path, flickering in an evening flame, I see her face. 3, mist rises off the lake, trees shiver, fish slide, spirits rise, ancestors sing away aloneness. 4, grandmother stands on sacred ground, the ancient ways are never lost, only, maybe, temporarily forgotten. Lakes of rice and Turtle Island riverbeds regenerate ancestral memory. It is not a gift easily forgotten. I remember my ancestors' words.
That gives me a lot of visuals. A very, very beautiful scene there. What do you mean by temporarily forgotten? And can you connect that with these? You know, why you named this book Anishinaabe Songs for a New Millennium?
So I think there's this myth that our traditions, whether it's our songs or our language or our, you know, our way of life has been forgotten, or that we disappeared as Native people. And there's Frances Densmore, was an ethnomusicologist who thought we were all going to be dead and gone. And so she recorded our songs. They're stored in the Smithsonian. But it was really the elders who kept the songs alive and passed them down. And a lot of this had to be in secret because of the oppression that we faced as Native people. And so people had to just kind of hide the ceremonial songs, hide what the language. But it was never really, it's never really disappeared. And so there's this whole movement to bring back the language, the traditions, the old teachings, the memory of what our culture really is. And so this collection of songs, poems is really about, and I really want to encourage people to Native people to get quiet enough to really hear what the ancestors, because they're not someplace else. They're here on the same space with us, but we just have to get quiet enough to hear them. And sometimes those songs don't come to us in our original language, in my case, Ojibwe. They'll come, you know, like through a dream in the middle of the night. So that's kind of the background for this whole book.
Okay. And you have a section here that's two performance songs. And these, I can imagine, are maybe meant to be sung?
So the last part of the book are actual songs that are set to Western musical notation. That have either been written for theater performances. I've worked with, primarily Brent Michael Davids, who's a classical composer, Native American, to write songs for choral groups. And so those songs that are set to Western notation are actually there in the back of the book. And then I also have done some work with Ann Millikan, who's another classical composer.
Okay. All right. Brett Michael David's composed our music here for Native America Calling. Very familiar with him. So you think about poetry as music as well. Is that right? How do you go kind of like back and forth writing specifically for, you know, just the poetry and then over to song?
I have zero training either as a poet, as a writer. I can't sing a note, but there's some, you know, when a number of years ago working for theater, it was like I could actually hear things in my head, and if I could get them out onto a piece of paper and sort of explain to the composer what it should sound like, they were able to then turn it into something. I'm not sure I'm answering your question. I write in all kinds of different genres and across different modalities. The majority of my poetry is spoken word poetry. That's where I actually, you know, I get up on stage and recite. So this particular book, Anishinaabe Songs, is a whole different category of work that I've been doing.
Okay. Yeah. Talk about those differences between, the subject and the style of this book here and your other poetry work.
So the spoken word is much more, I don't know, confrontational. You know, like I think my most published poem is, and the most requested one, starts out with what's an Indian woman to do when the white girls act more Indian than the Indians do. So it's kind of that in-your-face humor. It's meant to be, you know, spoken on stage. So there's a whole body of work there. But these songs and poems, dream songs, are much shorter, much more internal. That's the only way that I can describe it. They're internal, and then I bring them out.
Okay. And you say you've had no training. How did you get into poetry?
I just started writing. I think the first time junior high school, just start. I had read E.E. Cummings is one person that comes to mind. Mm-hmm. You know, that looked at other Shakespeare, you know, read Shakespeare, and then just started writing my own work. And I never knew that I could do anything with it. I just write it and stuff it in a drawer for, you know, a couple decades.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, let's go over to Tiffany Midge over in Moscow, Idaho. She's a poet, humorist, and author, and she's Hunk Papa Lakota. Welcome back to Native America Calling, Tiffany.
Hi there. Welcome to you, to my space.
All right. Thank you for letting us get into your space. So we're talking about, poetry, of course. And I wanted to ask you the same question. I'm curious. How did you get into poetry and who were maybe some of your Native inspirations for, you know, for going into your own poetry?
Yeah. Poetry was sort of born into me, I think. And I was always attuned to the world around me, very observant, had a lot of opinions. I just think that it's certain people are just, called to that. Called to be able to recognize things and name things. And the creative types too. I was just always very creative. And it's just a natural extension of all kinds of different creative expressions because, you know, I was a painter and I was sort of a natural born performer. And I like to sit down and be quiet and draw things and write things down. And the record Free to Be You and Me was probably an influence. So that's sort of kind of how it all started, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah, and you've been the poet laureate, right? Was that for Moscow or was that for Idaho?
That was for this little town that I live in called Moscow.
Oh, okay. Okay, cool. And when you have, you know, some of these different, gold, silver, bronze medals behind your name, I mean, what is that pressure like for you to, you know, come up with something new or maybe better than the last?
Gosh, what silver, bronze medal behind my name are you talking about? I'm not sure what that means.
Well, you'd be named poet laureate, yeah. we'll pick this up right after the break. Sorry about that. You can join us. We're talking about poetry today. Who are some of your favorite poets, poems? We're at 1-800-996-2848. We'll be back after this break.
Did you know that over 4 million children have lost their Medicaid coverage? Pediatrician and American Academy of Pediatrics spokesperson, Dr. Kimberly Avila Edwards, discusses the ongoing public health emergency.
The biggest concern about children losing Medicaid insurance is the health risks they face without access to care. Families may also be forced to shoulder the full cost of medical expenses without the safety net of coverage.
Visit localhelp.healthcare.gov to learn more. The American Academy of Pediatrics supports this show.
This is Native America Calling. I'm Andy Murphy, sitting in for Sean Spruce. We're focusing on Native poetry today, and we've been talking with poets Kim Blazer, Marcy Rendon, and Tiffany Ridge so far about their newly published and upcoming works. If you have a question or comment for these folks, give us a call at 1-800-996-2848. That's 1-800-99-NATIVE. I want to go back to Tiffany Midge. Talking about pressure to keep writing, coming up with something new and maybe better than what you've done in the past.
Yeah, coming up with new material is, you know, probably not the hardest thing in the world, because if you're in the world, then you just have all of the world to write about. Mm. And so it's not really that mysterious. This idea of inspiration, but you definitely have to sit down and make things look a certain way, sound a certain way, and that probably takes a little bit of practice, for it to be good, for it to sing, for it to resonate, and, you know, you want to hit all of these sort of points, but inspiration is out there everywhere.
All right, and you have something new coming in the future. Tell us about it.
I do. Thank you so much for asking. Yes, I have a collection of poetry that's due out in late spring, and it's called Horns, which is the title poem for mostly, it's more like a long sort of epic poem, more like a novella, I guess. So it's written in prose form, sort of, and it's unusual in that it's sort of a departure from what we would consider, you know, traditional Native American poetry. So that's like sort of that idea of, you know, what is Native American poetry is a little bit up for a debate with those kinds of things. But it centers on the daughter of Satan, the Antichrist, you know, within Christian mythologies. but it's just sort of a nice idea, and I just sort of riffed on it one day, and then it was actually years ago that I wrote it, but I've been working on it for a long time.
Okay.
And yeah, so it's funny. It's supposed to be funny. I mean, I like horror, so this book of poetry is sort of devoted to horror and, you know, the idea of cinema and, like, horror ideas within popular culture. And
right.
So it's definitely different and transgressive and grotesque. And, I mean, there's just all of these funny ideas that are being pulled together into all these various poems.
All right.
And one of the ones was about the Frankenstein's monster, like the Bride of Frankenstein.
Mm-hmm.
And with the popularity of the movie, Poor Things, it seems to have taken a lot of different imagery and ideas from that movie. But I wrote it way before the movie, like years and years before the movie. So it's another story for another time. But I'm just delighted by that and other ideas like King Kong and mostly dealing with women, like women in those types of movies and situations.
Mm-hmm. Well,
yeah,
you sent over a poem, The Monster's Bride. It questions the motives of her creator. Did you want to read that one for us?
I can. I'd have to find it in a second. I was all queued up for distracted from COVID-19.
Okay. You want to read that one? You can.
Yeah, sure. I love them both so much.
Okay. Well, maybe let's hear both of them, actually. Let's hear distracted from COVID-19.
Okay. The title, Distracted from COVID-19, Attention Shift to MIA Maiden from Land O'Lakes Butterbox. Okay. America mourns for the Indian figure who knelt like a supplicant before dairy, fatly blessed our milks, our cheeses, anointed our lands and shores. The Google tutorials surface, the boob trick, score the box and fold to make a window for her knees to jut through. Oh, our butter maiden brought all the boys to the yard. Twittersphere, so prostrate with grief, petitions are launched for the dairy princess. Oh, our pat, oh, Americana. Oh, our dab, oh, Disney-esque. Oh, our dollop, oh, heritage. The morning procession bears witness. Jolly Green Giant and Chicken of the Sea Mermaid, Uncle Ben and Aunt Jemima, Magically Delicious Leprechaun and Peter Pan, even the Argo Cornstarch Maiden and Mazola Margarine, you call it corn, we call it maize, spokes Indian, raise stocks in solidarity. Mia, aptly named our Butter Girl mascot, the only Indian woman gone missing that anyone notices, anyone cares about.
All right. Definitely understand and see that one. I just love being at the grocery stores and and, you know, I have been, you know, in tuned with the whole Land O'Lakes issue and how, you know, she disappeared. But it was really almost a shock. And it just like reminded me, oh, my gosh, it actually happened, you know, because stuff like that happens like after years and years and years of protesting. But to actually see it in a grocery store, you know, to see the Land O'Lakes girl disappear, that was pretty cool to see. Thank you so much, Tiffany, for that. Is there anything else you'd like to say about this poem and what you really want folks to take away from it?
I'm not sure. I can't really say. I just just the idea that this, I mean, I call it sort of a cultural phenomena, and that it, this thing occurred. And I suppose people would need maybe a little bit more background, but I think most people in Indian country are aware of it. You know, if they ever go on social media or anything like that, it was all over social media. And just this phenomena, this cultural phenomena that, you know, that white folks, you know, in the overculture cared so much about this logo on this box of butter, for Christ's sake. And, you know, and the reality is that so many of our Native people go missing, you know, to sort of bounce off of what Kim was talking about within her poetry. And, you know, it's one of those absurd, ironic things that, you know, people in Indian country are all too aware of. Just, you know, it's just so, it's so awful that it's funny. It's so horrible that, you know, that it's true, that it hits on all of those sorts of things. So I guess I could talk a lot about it, actually, once I get started. But the takeaway, though, I'm not sure. I don't know what the takeaway would be. Awareness, right? Mm-hmm. You know, an understanding. That would definitely be a great place to start from.
All right. Yeah, definitely can't wait for the new book, Horns, to come out. We'll be keeping our eyes out for that. I actually want to go to Kinsale Drake right now, as the hour winds down here. She's in Oklahoma City. She is a poet and founder of the Indian Girls Book Club, and she's Diné. Welcome to Native America Calling, Kinsale.
Hi, it's nice to be here.
You've been making waves on social media with the Yistha book drop tour. Tell us about that. I see, you know, 10,000 books given away in 5 days.
Yeah, so last week, well, it was April 1st through 5th, Indian Girls Book Club was out on the Navajo and Hopi reservations, and we were distributing 10,200 books for free by Native authors to youth, students, elders, whoever wanted free books by Native authors, as well as mutual aid like diapers, shoes, Bamba socks. And we were also featuring a bunch of really cool Diné artists at every stop. So we traveled in the four directions, and we had some pop-ups along the way, and it was really fun. And then all of us got sick after, but none of us got COVID. So we're all celebrating still, and we all were as safe as we could be, and I think that's all that we could ask for.
All right. Awesome. And you wanted to do this, I guess, like Navajo Nation is a food desert. Is it also a book desert?
Yeah, so it is called a book desert by the federal government, and, you know, according to colonial measures of measuring literature in the home. So that's technically, you know, the likelihood that a family has 100 or more books in the home. If they have less than that, it's considered a book desert. But a lot of the narrative shifting we were trying to do with this drop was showing that, you know, the place is not inherently barren. Deserts are beautiful and giving and generous things. And a lot of us that call that place home, rather it's a lack of resources because of settler colonialism that means that we don't have access to Native books out there. And I think that's, you know, a narrative that people are very familiar with. They don't need to be taught that or told that. So really it was a matter of empowering the youth that were already there on the reservation, getting them involved, getting them books, like just straight up books that they liked and that they wanted to read and that had positive depictions of Native peoples contemporarily.
Oh, awesome. All right. What were some of the books in this collection?
Oh, the ones that we gave away? Oh, yeah. My gosh. We had, like, I want to say maybe 50 to 55 different titles. So
nice.
People had a choice at every stop, which was nice. But the biggest donors were Levine Carrito, which publishes Darcy Little Badger, Andrea Rogers, a couple other authors, Eric Gansworth, Hatchet Books as well was a big donor. Mm-hmm. also had we had a mission to support financially with the funds we did have available. We wanted to support Indigenous booksellers and indie publishers. So we were reaching out to a lot of smaller publishers to purchase books at wholesale prices. And, you know, they were offering discounts, but we still wanted to financially support Indigenous writers that relied on small presses to get their books out. So one of those was Dr. Amanda Tachin, and she writes this amazing book about slaying monsters in higher education, and that was published by Columbia University Press. And they, I mean, when we were talking to them, they hadn't really fulfilled that big of an order mm-hmm. before, because they're a university press and they're pretty far from the reservation. But, you know, I think they even felt the urgency of what we were doing, and it was just a great experience. And having Dr. Tachin out there was phenomenal, and having other authors out there was just, you know, incredible. Okay. And excuse me if my voice is a little, I got strep throat personally, so I'm recovering. Uh-huh. So if I start hacking up along, that's why.
No problem. It sounds great on this side. But, you know, we're running out of time here. I wanted to make sure we heard a poem from you. Put on that KTNN is what you sent in. Can you read that for us?
Yeah, and this is from my forthcoming collection, The Sky Was Once a Dark Blanket. Mm. It won the National Poetry Series this past year, and it's coming out September 15th. So this is from that collection.
All right, good.
Put on that KTNN. My mother was raised on Patsy Cline and Hank Williams' country that bounced in on her father's radio. Even today, I know I'm nearing home. When the pop music crackles into KTNN, licks of fluent Navajo flitting between Loretta Lynn and Johnny Cash. They are interludes, too, for drum beats and throaty covers of well-loved tunes put on by some local boys' gas station banjo and hot rocket guitar, a strong woman that sings the seasons over a hand drum. Then it is back to more Loretta Lynn. All contradictions find a home in the body, the insect skin of the car sluicing the Arizona desert as the cicadas pick up their grand instruments. How else to know you enter a land of monuments, not a wasteland, loved by radio waves and peach trees and small, silly dogs that bridge the distance between a chapter house and the nearest Sonics in a city. The moon rocks darken into pine, pine into slick rock, and the whole world remembers what it once was. Grand ocean, sun, plankton, pearl, blood, ancestor, cloud. Radio rainbows the most violent parts of the land, thrashed by thunderstorms and sea. As the Rattles pick up their backing track and Hank Williams rolls in all over again, easy and blue.
Awesome. I love that. Totally sounds like home to me as well. I'm also from Navajo Nation, from Crown Point, New Mexico. Totally grew up on some of that. No, not some, but hours and hours of KTNN. Thank you so much, Kinsale. We didn't get to Tiffany Midge's Monster Bride poetry. You'll have to wait until her book comes out in a couple months. I want to thank our guests we had on today, Kim Blazer, Marcy Rendon, Tiffany Ridge, and Kinsale Drake. Join us next week when we start off with a look at arguments that Facebook, TikTok, and other social media are promoting a mental health crisis for Native youth. Have a good weekend. I'm Andy Murphy.
Support for this program provided by Vision Maker Media, who envisions a world changed and healed by understanding Native stories and the public conversations they generate. Nurturing the next generation of storytellers with courage, generosity, creativity, respect, and commitment. 45-plus years of Native stories and Indigenous knowledge through film and media can be found at visionmakermedia.org, whose slogan is, "Together, we are vision makers."
OCO, April is National Alcohol Awareness Month. Join a support group to help yourself. If you have Medicaid or are insured through the marketplace, you may qualify for treatment options. For more information, contact your Indian health care provider or visit healthcare.gov or call 1-800-318-2596. A message from the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services.
Native America Calling is produced in the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico, by Kwanic Broadcast Corporation, a Native nonprofit media organization. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, with support from the Public Radio Satellite Service. Music is by Brent Michael Davids. Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.